were on an advisory committee to the Secretary of Commerce. And we had told the secretary, we had pulled the data and said, listen, you know, 98% of our active pharmaceutical ingredients are coming from China. You know, this is not smart. And it wasn't because it was China. It was because who in their right mind would have a supply chain that narrow?
Welcome to North Point of View. Walter, great to be with you.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
Doing great, man. We need to talk about tariffs.
Yes.
We can go a lot of different directions. Let's just start at where we sit today, not necessarily looking too far back or too far in the future right now, but the issue of tariff risk management, right?
Right.
What do you do if you're CFO, COO, trying to figure it out right now, today, real time? You've given me some stats here that are fascinating. How to work the system right now, how to stay alive.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
How not to be roadkill. And there are people that are figuring it out, right?
Oh, yes, they are.
And in every chaotic environment produces opportunities, and there are winners and losers on the other side.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
So
what's the decision matrix?
So before we do that, we have to think about this in the context of what's going on. So, we have a PowerPoint slide with a bunch of notes on it. If you're interested, shoot us an email. We're happy to share it with you. But it lists a bunch of industries, what percentage of the companies have already restructured their supply chains just recently, last year or so. And the numbers are very high. They are, you know, somewhere in the 60 to 90% range. Auto industry, massive restructuring
That's
going
huge.
On. Exactly. So there are a lot of, you know, things that are impacting the decision to do so, including stuff like regionalizing your supply chain. Try to make it shorter so that, you know, you don't run into the difficulties of making something as far away as China and having to put it into a assembly plant in, say, the Midwest. So long distance, you know, even telephone calls and meetings are hard to do because of the time difference. So China's a great deal, and you put up with those difficulties because, you know, very efficient, you know, et cetera. So you try to regionalize, and as part of regionalizing, we're seeing the evolution of a barbell strategy. And what that means is we have to diversify our sources of supply. This is also something that the U.S. government is pushing. And, you know, if you go back to COVID, it was a horrible realization. Although a couple of friends of mine and me, we were on an advisory committee to the Secretary of Commerce. And we had told the secretary, we had pulled the data and said, listen, you know, 98% of our active pharmaceutical ingredients are coming from China. You know, this is not smart. And it wasn't because it was China. It was because who in their right mind would have a supply chain that narrow? That's just, it's insane. But the problem is, if you look at companies who build these things, if you've got something right now that's working and you go fix it, there's a good chance you're going to lose your job. There isn't enough product on the shelf, you know, because of your... You found a better deal, but it takes a little while for things to work. In the middle of the business cycle, if you miss your sales target, you're done.
Right.
But when there is an emergency, when, you know, the proverbial crap hits the fan, that's the time when you can make change. And right now, we went through COVID, then we went through the Houthis, and then we went through, you know, Obliteration Day. Right, April 2nd, you know, sitting there watching my 401k. This isn't going to go away. I don't see the world as returning to the stability that we had before. You know, we've got you know, the quote unquote BRIC gang: Brazil, Russia, India, China. Actually, it's BRICS in South Africa, and you know, China trying to replace the dollar with the renminbi as the world currency, The only problem is I would never hedge my interest rate and foreign exchange risk on the Chinese yield curve. I would do it on the US curve. You know, maybe you could do it on the Japanese curve, but the reality is we have the deepest, most liquid, and most transparent markets in the world.
Yeah.
So when Sweden issues a bond, they'll swap the krona payments into US dollar payments, and then they'll manage their interest rate risk on the US Treasury yield curve. And companies do that. Coca-Cola does that. IBM does that. If you've got currencies from all over the world, that's what you do. So what that means is the efforts to displace the dollar and change the economic order is not going to stop, and it's going to continue to create volatility.
Right.
And if it isn't the Houthis, it's the Iranians. If it isn't the Iranians, whatever. Volatility is higher, and it's going to stay higher. We're not going to go back to the peaceful 90s, where China was still too poor to do much, and Russia had collapsed.
Well, and the other part of it is with social media, et cetera, anytime an event happens anywhere on the planet, everybody on the planet knows about it.
Yeah, it propagates like
right.
everything. So, and we are living in an increasingly globalizing world. Now, what cracks me up is I've been working in the port industry now since 2006, it's 19 years. Every few years, some analyst on Wall Street writes a paper about the end of globalization.
Yeah.
Oh, shut up. Okay, come on. What are you talking about? You know, the 73-74, Arab war, that's the end of globalization. Then we got into the Iran-Iraq war of 1980, and it's the end of when you can see world trade was rising. These events occur, it drops. Oh, see, it's the end of it, and then back up. And I go to the DHL website. They do these studies using their data with the NYU Stern School of Business guys. And they don't just look at globalization in terms of goods flow, but they look at telephone connections. Mm. People calling each other in other parts of the world, the sharing of movies and shows around the world. And that has not reversed. But what we had before, the government started to push the guys out of China, wasn't globalization. It was Chinaization. We close the factory here, I go open it there, but that's the only place I source stuff. China was more globalized than the US was. China was getting components from, 40 countries to build an iPhone and then send us the iPhone. And so I were backward companies. And I say backward. When I lived in Europe in the 90s into 2000s, European companies were globalized. They were producing and distributing all over the world. They were like Coca-Cola. I mean, where can you go on this planet and not find a Coke?
Yeah, I was, that reminds me, I was in Tokyo 2 weeks ago, and I just don't do it very often, but I just had to go to McDonald's, right? I just had to see what a quarter pounder was like in Tokyo, and I got the samurai burger, it was so good.
Oh my gosh. And that's a phrase you never hear. I went to McDonald's and it was so good.
It was so good. But your point being that there's no putting the genie back in the bottle.
No.
I mean, it's going to increase every year. There will be setbacks, but then as we work through those issues, we become more efficient, we become smarter, we become better, we become stronger. And that's what you're seeing through this application of terrorist risk management, right?
Exactly.
The companies are getting stronger.
American companies are, the rest of the world companies were already there. The European guys, the Japanese guys, even China, as an economic machine, they were ahead of the curve. So, and it seems contradictory. Well, aren't we turning things, inward and trying to reshore things? And there's a lot of confusion about what happened. I just wrote a report for the US Department of Transportation, and in it, I pulled the data on industrial production. And for decades, industrial production and the production of consumer goods, this is Federal Reserve data, it rose together all the way up until even after China entered the WTO and mm-hmm. started selling us a lot of stuff. But when we hit the 2007-2009, you know, horrible recession, manufacturing of everything dropped. And then as we got out of that recession, overall industrial production went back to where it was. It's been flat since then, but manufacturing of consumer goods did not come back. Mm. It bounced up some, but it didn't return to its previous peak level. And so a lot of this offshoring or whatever we want to call it has been consumer companies, people making things for consumers. And the reason you have to offshore a lot is because, you know, this is a nice jacket somebody gave me. And what's the market for, you know, jackets in the U.S.? There's 330 million Americans. The middle class is about, what, 120 million, 140 million. And, you know, of that, there's only, you know, half of that is men. And of those men, only a certain percentage buy the jackets. So that's it. Your market's limited. I want to go sell to China. They got 1.4 billion people. There are a lot of men there who probably wear jackets. And it's a big middle class. The problem is their middle class income is not equivalent to the US. So I can't take a worker who makes, you know, 20, 30 bucks an hour, make something and then export it to China to somebody who makes $5 an hour.
Right.
Okay, you know, $5 an hour, much better than 50 cents an hour or 5 cents an hour than, you know, 20 years ago in China. Middle class is growing, but I can't sell to the consumers there based off my cost basis here.
Right.
But if you're going to make stuff for India middle class and China middle class and the rest of the world middle class, then you're going to have to make it there.
And you need to make it there.
And the excess that you produce, since you're making it there because it's cheaper to make it there, is going to come back to the U.S. So sometimes a lot of the offshoring gets labeled as evil and bad and nasty. It isn't. It's a natural economic thing.
It's open market economics, right?
That's right. I don't think we're going to see Nike start producing a lot of t-shirts in the U.S. It doesn't make sense to me.
Doesn't work that way.
So in this world that's become, you have to work with the world. You got to be, you know, competitive. So for you to remain competitive and it means you now are given permission to manage your risk. You don't get the Wall Street, you know, analysts yelling at you, why are your costs higher? They're higher because we have to make our supply chain resilient and we've got to, you know, regionalize some of our production. We talked about that in a previous podcast. Therefore, what I have to do is create a barbell strategy. I have to find more suppliers, more supply countries, and if I do that, then I'm going to have to use more gateways to get this stuff into the U.S.
Yeah.
And so what we're seeing here in Savannah is a consequence of that shift away from, you know, being too China-centric and going to India. And as we talked about before, India stuff comes to the U.S., you know, via the Red Sea or around Cape Good Hope until the Houthis knock it off, and it goes to East Coast ports.
Yeah.
West Coast ports will get stuff, but not like the East Coast does. So if I'm suddenly going to buy my bicycles not in China to sell in the stores here, I go to India, then I'm going to bring this stuff into Savannah. And we've been seeing that traffic. And I was at a conference a few weeks ago. It was in Jacksonville. It was the Florida Supply Chain Council conference. And it was a port session, and I was asked to moderate it. So we had the ports of Tampa, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Jacksonville, you know, the big guys. And I asked them, I said, are you seeing any changes in supply chains that affect you? And they said, yeah, we're seeing a lot more textiles and clothing coming from Colombia and less coming from Asia, all over Asia, not just a reduction in China, but Vietnam, Taiwan, et cetera.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they're diversifying their suppliers, but now they have to bring their stuff into the U.S. not via the West Coast, which would be a straight across the Pacific run, but they're bringing them into Florida, to the Gulf Coast, up the East Coast. And so the ports in this part of the country are benefiting from it. And this is what I mean by a barbell strategy. You find more suppliers and you find more gateways. Your supply chain becomes more resilient. You're more nimble. And quite frankly, if you do it right, the costs don't have to be higher. You just, you know, it's, that's what a lot of my consulting work is about. I help people select ports when they're changing or restructuring their supply chain.
The hard work makes us stronger.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, and that manages your tariff risk.
Right.
Because, you know, unless we get another April 2nd kind of event, everybody pays.
I love your impersonation of that guy.
But you want
to. Speaking of Big Macs, I just need to put a pile of Big Macs in front of you.
Oh, right? Absolutely. I would fit the bill. I have a few things in common with them, and that would be one of them. I love Big Macs.
So, you know, through this regionalization, what you're seeing is ports like Savannah, Charleston, who can expand, but we're in play. You've got, again, winners and losers.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got folks that are really digging into the issues here, risk management, mm-hmm. coming out on the other side.
Exactly. They are looking at a range of factors. I mean, not to read the whole slide, I won't, but, you know, you have a new regulations that affect, you know, cold chain, you know, refrigerated, frozen food. So that's causing changes. We've got the energy issue that, you know, you need to make sure you're going to have access to the energy. The CHIPS Act basically makes all the chips have to be made in the U.S. and it's creating a lot of turmoil. There are, sustainable sourcing issues out there, regardless of what the current administration's policies are or the last administration's, doesn't matter. The younger consumers are worried about the environment.
Yeah.
And so they want things, they want to buy stuff that has a low carbon footprint. And if that's what the market wants, that's what you have to give them.
Yeah. Think it through.
Exactly.
Figure it out. Walter, great being with you, man.
Absolutely, Mark.
Thanks so much.
I'll see you soon.
All right. Thanks, guys.